You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast. I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. This week, I speak to JJ Asghar of IBM. JJ is someone that I met on the road while going out and speaking with people about what I do. He kind of does a similar thing. He is a developer advocate over at IBM. He likes to talk to people about Kubernetes, modern operations, deployment, things like that. Not all that far different from what I do over at Microsoft. And so he and I tend to really see eye to eye on things that we've done in our career and the things that we're doing now. So I really appreciate him giving me some time. I know I haven't had a lot of updates on the podcast lately. Just to give you some reasons why. One, I've been really busy. I got a lot of stuff going on here, and I am taking on a lot of new tasks. One of them, I've been doing DevOps Days New York City organization with a team of people. We've come together to kind of put together a final idea of where we're going to be for 2020. You'll all find out about that soon. I'll give you tons of information for you who want to apply to speak at it or those who want to attend. I'll be going to a ton of Microsoft Ignite events. First of all, I'll be at the Ignite event in Orlando in just about another week and a half. This coming week, I will be at DevOps Enterprise Summit. They have been kind enough to provide me with a podcast space for Friday. So that's Wednesday of the DevOps Enterprise Summit. I will have a podcast suite, and if you would like to come and do some conversations with me while you're there as well, reach out oncallnightmares@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at oncallnightmare. So let's get into our conversation with JJ, who, like I said, is a cloud advocate or developer advocate rather for IBM, and I think he's going to give you some really cool info on what he's done. So let's get into it. You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast, and when I get a chance to, which has not been quite as frequently just based on my schedule, I talk to technologists who spent time on call. Today I am joined by someone that is not just a developer advocate, but he's a developer advocate for Big Blue. That's right, IBM. I've got JJ Asghar with me today. He grew up in Austin, Texas, lives there still, loves a good strong stout, which I can agree with, a hoppy IPA, which I won't, because I got to be honest with you, JJ, I'm not into perfume that much. That's just he's a member of the Church of Emacs, although he still jumps into Vim on remote machines, and I can appreciate that. Ubuntu over CentOS, but secretly wants FreeBSD everywhere. As a child of the ports tree, I can kind of get with you there, man. Ruby, Go, Python, you've done stuff. Node, you're a father and a husband, and you go out there to help people be button makers and not button pushers. It's JJ. How you doing today, man?
I'm doing great, and thanks for that. That was pretty good. And you know, I will debate you on that perfume comment, but, you know.
Look, I've said that my biggest issue that I've had with IPA, and it's the reason why I just really never got into it, is I've always felt that perfumey kind of, but I don't know what you would call it. It just never really can't get down with it.
Yeah. Well, I was a home brewer for about 10 years.
Oh, and, wow, cool.
I actually won some awards with the IPAs I created. And I got really deep into that world, and eventually my wife was like, "Hey, you need to get rid of all this stuff. Like, it's taking up our garage." And I'm like, "Well, what can I get a new car?" And she's like, "Yes, if you get rid of all your homebrewing stuff and get rid of it, I'll let you buy a new car." So I got a new car out of it.
Well, that was nice of her. So you've been in technology since what, around 2007? Would it be?
So that's when when I started actually tracking my career.
Okay, that's where your DevOps career really took off. But before that, you had other places that you kind of were doing systems management, correct?
Yeah. So I actually started in the industry when I was 15.
Okay.
And, cool. I actually the company I was working at, which I won't mention, actually asked me to drop out of high school and work for them full time. And I looked at them and I'm like, I know you're going to give me a lot of money, but I'm a 15-year-old kid. I probably should get my diploma first. So I was their summer intern for a long, for about 3 or 4 years, where I ran or I helped build a bunch of NT servers for this corporation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so early on, I met a few people that kind of had that experience where there were companies that were like, do you really need to be in high school? And at least one or two people I know dropped out and got their GED, but I don't know. I think times have changed and that there's less of that going on because the super kid that drops out of high school just doesn't seem to be a thing that people really want to do. So go ahead.
I was going to say, like, it's the whole idea that, like, there's only so many people out there that understood computers back when I was 15. So mm-hmm. What was that? That was, oh shit, that's 21 years ago. So 21 years ago, like, there were so few people who actually really, really wanted to understand how computers were put together, how a SCSI drive actually worked and things like that. So they would have to find that. Nowadays, with the way the internet is so ubiquitous, I mean, we're on a Zoom right now talking, right? Like, it's insane. Like, it's part of everybody's life. So that super kid just doesn't exist. Exactly.
Interesting. So then after you start that, how long were you doing that kind of work, and how long were you do that till you, I guess, decided to move on to your next big thing and eventually move on to Dell?
Yeah, exactly. So I was a pretty much a hands-on data center monkey for a little while. I learned how to run a couple of little small startups in Austin, Texas. And eventually, if you fast forward, I ended up at a company that was another startup that where I really learned how to become on call. So okay. I was always kind of like the nerd in the corner. And then one day I became something called a production engineer.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And that's what we actually called the people on call who were responsible for the infrastructure at the time. And this was back around 2010, 2009, somewhere around there. Okay. And maybe a little bit earlier than that. I have no concept of time. basically, this was when we still had a pager. And they were like, okay, there's a men at this time. There was a four-man team where you need to make sure that four data centers around the world are up and running at all times. And basically what happened was we used something at the time called Groundwork, which was a fork of Nagios. That would actually run some really basic bash scripts and see if the system was up and doing what it was supposed to be doing. At one point in my on-call career at that specific company, we actually got to a point where we actually had an everything is okay alarm.
Okay.
So if you know the Simpsons reference, when Homer has that, when he's trying to be an inventor, he creates a everything is okay alarm that every 5 seconds a really loud beep would go off. Well, imagine getting a page every 5 minutes from Nagios telling you everything's okay. Now, we were a 24/7 company from all over the world, people using our product. So that means when you were on call, every 5 minutes, your pager would buzz. Now, imagine what would happen in the long term with burnout, if every 2 weeks you're on call and responsible or the escalation and the everything okay alarm is going off. We eventually learned to turn someone to a night shift, basically, but then that caused some other problems where that person was completely isolated, utterly isolated into a little corner. They weren't even part of our team necessarily. It'd speak maybe 15 minutes to us in total, like this machine's having a problem or whatever. And that was it. And that was the worst of the worst of the nightmare, to play off of the name of this podcast, of my life.
Does that make sense? I think Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think my very first real monitoring system was at a company I won't name as well. And what they did was they threw a wrapper over Nagios, and which a lot of people wanted to do back in like the 2000s, early 2000s. Everyone decided to write wrappers around Nagios or write some sort of extra thing, which, to be honest with you, makes sense. Nagios didn't look great.
That's true.
But it did the job. But they created this wrapper around it. It was called What's Down. And it was just a list of what's down. And, you know, once in a while, the What's Down list would get updated and we would have alerts. And someone would have to monitor what's down. And that was their entire job, was just watching refresh of what's down and seeing, oh, okay, we've got another machine down better. And it was early monitoring for production, and sure, it worked, but it wasn't efficient.
Mm-hmm.
No, so let's move down a little bit into your career. You spend some time, obviously, getting your degree over at Park University, and while you're doing that, you move over to HP for a little while. Mm-hmm. Then you go over to UT at Austin, mm-hmm. and you spend some time as a software engineer. And then you really start moving forward and you start picking up some places like People Admin. And then for a while, you were partner architect with Chef. Can you tell me a little bit about like what a partner architect was?
You know, honestly, your guess is as good as mine. So after I was a production engineer, like you were saying, I moved on to other companies. I started learning how to use configuration management to my advantage. Mm-hmm. That was actually one of the things I learned from that on-call life at those previous companies, sure. Where I started learning to let the bots do the work for me, right? And gotcha. Eventually it got me to Chef because I was so good with using configuration management, because I would declare exactly what I was expecting to happen with the computer that in what state that I needed to be in. And I did it in a repeatable fashion. At that previous company when I was a production engineer, we actually used one of the very first versions of Puppet. Mm. It's a really interesting to see how small the world is, because one of the people high up inside of Puppet actually was one of my mentors at the time at that previous company. And we eventually learned how to use Puppet to do massive builds of infrastructure. So we wouldn't have to send someone to Germany to go work inside the data center. We could just use a Bastion node, create some manifests, and as long as the German, what we call were smart hands, mm-hmm. That was a term, to call in, they would be like the people that would actually type stuff on the actual computer for you. By the way, smart hands is not a good name by any standard.
I've definitely had to have remote hands or smart hands, which you've had with like third parties at data centers. So I've been there.
Yeah, it's bad. It's real bad. So as long as they got the machines up and running into a place where we could use something like Cobbler to install those machines.
Wow.
So we were, so it was by the time I was finishing my tenure at that company, mm-hmm. We'd actually created almost a lights out to working node or working machine inside of an actual pool from soup to nuts.
Wake on land, then do everything else, if you will.
Yeah, it was really, really, really impressive. But it took a really long time to get there. And during this time period, the thing that really, really resonated with me when I started like reflecting back on that time in my life, it was genuinely the monitoring, mm-hmm. and how much of my on-call life was driven and focused around a little red bar that would pop up inside of Nagios, the live view, and see that I would have to go do this machine because this thing is broken. And it was a Java application too. So I was a system administrator, right? Like I do everything inside of Bash. I'm still basically a system administrator, And I'm not gonna, I very rarely pull in a programming language to do any of my work. I just write a bunch of bash scripts and use the tooling. But I would have to learn all this Java and all these things around Java, how and how the Tomcat server worked and things like that. It really, really like blew my mind and made me realize that the industry was not just basically, you know, using or learning how to install a SCSI CD-ROM. It's sure. now how to orchestrate like an orchestra, right? Like it's you have to make sure all the pieces fit together. I'm rambling, I'm sorry.
No, please. No, I think this stuff is great because there's a tremendous difference between what I guess people looked at systems administrators in the late 90s and early 2000s to what system administrators eventually did. System administrators, at least this is my take on it, and you can correct me if you feel like you need to. Early on, system administrators were simply computer management people. They managed the utilization of computers by companies, whether it is a small group of computers or a large group. And then eventually these people moved on to not just computers that are used by individuals, but computers that were used by groups of people and then eventually by customers. And that's mm-hmm. kind of the way I've looked at that kind of the way that system administration has evolved to the point now where the globe is looking at your computers, and now we have SRE instead of just standard system administration, and we have huge, huge practices instead of just simple runbooks that you've made internally.
Oh wow, I haven't heard that term in a long time. That was a trigger word, a runbook. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there's a graph that I reference every once in a while where back in like there's an inflection point of how many system administrators to computers. Is mm-hmm. different over time. Like you would have one system administrator take care of your mail transfer or your MTA, right? Or your, mm-hmm. your web server. And sure. that was like in the 90s and the 80s.
The mail admin.
Yeah,
the messaging exactly. The messaging admin. Sure, I absolutely know what you're talking about.
Yep. And then as you go longer in time, now sysadmins are more responsible for literally thousands of computers. Or mm-hmm. if you take it into the containerization with cloud, right? Like the cloud technologies, you're more worrying about a mainframe and an application stack that could have literally hundreds and hundreds of microservices inside of it. It's a completely sure. different way of looking at the world. And it's amazing that how many people have moved past the idea of metal running the internet, right?
Yeah, it's been a big change, absolutely.
Exactly.
So let's move ahead a little, and I want to get into a very important part of the podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, there are rules to this podcast, and I don't know if you know about the rules, but I'm going to share you with you the rules, as I do on every episode. Rule one, do not incriminate yourself while telling us a story. Do not incriminate others, because we do blameless retrospectives, don't we? That's the way I look at it now. That's what everyone keeps telling me. And three, help us learn, because like I said, these are retrospectives. We look at what we've done and show others how they can learn and avoid the problems. So why don't you give us a little interesting story, whether it's a specific incident or just how your on-call life changed.
Sure. So I'm going to tell a little of a war story of me being on call and having to deal with being inside of a data center at the exact same time. Okay, so I was working at this company, and one of the responsibilities of the person on call was if they were relatively close to the data center. By the way, I live in Austin, Texas, and our data center at this time was in Dallas. If you were relatively close to the data center and on call and something happened, you would have to go to the data center and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if your listeners don't know, Austin, Texas to Dallas, Texas is about a 3-hour car drive, and it's a straight shot, right? So imagine what happens when you get a page from the Everything is Okay alarm, and then all of a sudden you find out one of your hard drives is failing inside of one of your storage nodes. And you go ahead and call your superior being like, hey, this is a problem. One of our storage nodes is failing. What do we do? And he literally said, get in a car. And I was like, what? He's like, get in a car. You need to go change out that hard drive. And I was like, it's 2 a.m. He's like, good. You'll get there about 5 before business starts.
Jeez.
And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, okay. So I got in a car and started driving north. And I got to the data center about 5, like you said, which was nice. And I pull out the machine. And it was actually Dell hardware at the time. And there was something called a PERC inside of it. Mm-hmm. I think it was a PERC 7, maybe? Or 7.5? PERC 5, PERC 7?
Those are the RAID cards, right? The PERC RAID?
That's right. Yeah.
I remember those. If those are those Dell PERC, like, God, I remember those. There was integrated RAID controllers. Sure. I remember these.
Yes. Well, this one was not integrated. This was actually a card inside of the actual machine. And I learned a very, very strong lesson in this time. One of those hard drives was failing, so I ripped it out and I put it back in. And so before I did that, I shut the machine down. And being that I was inside of a data center and there's a lot of electricity and I was by myself, I was like, hey, I should probably unplug the back of this machine to make sure I don't electrocute myself, right? Like, there's a lot of power around here. It makes sense.
Oh boy. So here we go.
Yeah. Yep. You see where this is going.
Oh, I do. Go for it. I'm waiting.
Yep. And so I go ahead and pull the machine out and I pull out the hard drive and I plug it back in and I power it on and I get this little beeping noise and then it says no operating system found.
Oh boy.
And I'm like, what? And then I rebooted it and eventually I got into the RAID card or the RAID. And I discovered that it wasn't actually the hard drive failing. It was the battery failing on the card.
Yeah. And that what I've seen that leads you to, like, I remember there were those early ones where if the battery was dying, it wouldn't just drop you into a warning and then let you continue your post. It would hang there and it would just be like, hey, guess what, Jerkoff? You got to change the battery or you got to press F2. Make a decision.
Exactly. And what I should say is there was a lot of customer data on that RAID array. Mm-hmm. And this was the only place that customer data was on. And at the time, these were documents that Sarbanes-Oxley might be asking for. So, yeah.
Obviously something really, really bad happened here.
Yes.
And now you've got to figure out how to recover this RAID and get this back and running. So how does that process begin?
I called because it's 5 a.m. and I've been up all night. I call my boss and my boss's boss. We set up that good old crit sit, you know, the critical situation call that everyone calls in. And because of how big the company was at the time, I even had my CEO, CTO, my finance person, my legal person, everyone on the call by 8 a.m. when they find out that we're about to lose all this data, or we have lost all this data. Interestingly enough, though, we discovered that there was a company that we could ship all these drives to be able to pull it off one by one or something like that. Which we ended up saving it. But the moral of this story and what I was saying at the very beginning of this podcast is that it's the idea of monitoring your infrastructure and understanding what was actually happening and even going through the correct steps to understand what's happening, things still can go horribly, horribly wrong.
Sure.
And also, very importantly, the buddy system, the four eyes is so, so important. As I said earlier, I only had a team of 4 people, right? Sure. And we had a 24/7, like we wouldn't take vacations or anything because our responsibility was to make sure these data centers were up.
Sure. And I remember the bad old days where, you know, vacations were few and far between because of coverage more than anything else.
Exactly. So I learned very strongly, and this has molded my career as I've moved forward, to always have a buddy, always have understanding of what's going on. And when your company will have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to send these hard drives to a third party to get machines off, to get data off of it, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars at the time. And this was a startup, so there's that was a lot of money for the OPEX, because it came out of OPEX, right, instead of CAPEX. And it almost caused the company to fold, right? Because there was just a little watch battery on a RAID card that told me the wrong thing. It's one of those things that observability and understanding that the monitoring you have is really important. And I cannot stress this enough.
Yeah, I've learned a lot of that from the people that I've spoken with lately. That so much that goes into perfecting monitoring, it requires you to actually audit what you've done.
Exactly.
And to keep an eye on how far that monitoring spread goes, because you could end up waking people up for no freaking reason, simply because you just haven't deprecated certain alerts, which just serve no purpose anymore.
Exactly. It's back to that everything is okay alarm, right? Mm-hmm. Every 5 minutes, if I didn't feel my pager buzz, I knew something was wrong. So I learned what 5 minutes, first of all, I had the concept of what 5 minutes was. Right? Like at any moment during the day, because I was trained that this little buzzer would buzz every 5 minutes. I knew when that gap was too long. And to your point about auditing the system and understanding what your infrastructure does, understanding how all this comes together is so valuable. There was a running joke when I first started, at that company, is we used Outlook at the time. And, they actually said, my mentor at the time, not the one that I eventually got, but the first one I got at the company, he said, you need to start learning how to do Outlook rules. You need to use Outlook rules to filter out all this noise. And in my own naive understanding of what I just brought myself into, I was like, sure, okay, I guess I'll learn how to do some Outlook rules to put things in buckets so I can understand what's happening. As someone who's been in the industry for a long time now, if I ever hear that from somebody, what you should do is immediately ask, why do I need to filter alerts, right? Like, why do we have this alert if I don't need to ever see it, right? Like, there's no reason this alert should exist. And if somebody wants to see it for some specific reason, cool, that's fine, I understand. But why monitor something that you don't need to care about?
Yeah, tremendous point.
Yep.
And so what I've learned, and I think I've told this to a few people, I think that the monitoring template is a detriment as opposed to a thing that you should look to first. While I think there are baselines that you may need to have in your monitoring, to have a default template that goes on everything doesn't seem useful anymore.
Yeah. And it's to take it one step farther is like watching CPU cycles or right on a machine. Why do you care? Like, okay, that one time that one specific machine might hit 99%, or is it always at 99%? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And if it needs to go, or even better, the load average, that's the one.
Yeah.
Oh my jeez.
The load average in Linux has been the greatest misnomer for people, I think, as far as when things are actually wrong. That number is so, I don't know, it can either be a really good telling point or it can be completely just misleading on what you're supposed to do next. And I've seen a lot of moments, even included like myself, chasing my tail after things related to high load average, when high load average was actually fine. You wanted all that traffic. But the assumption is that our servers should look pretty. Right? Yep. And their state should be pretty. Like, we don't want it to run hot because we assume that eventually it's going to fail. But I think that that's a big change that I've seen in the last like 5 to 7 years. It's okay if things run hot, if they're busy, if they're active, as long as they work.
Exactly. And also with the way the industry is now, with those machines running hot, you want to pare down your footprint to what you actually need, right? Auto-scaling exists for a reason, right? Like, if you need more machines, just scale up. If you don't need them, scale them down. And then hit that 99%. That's fine. It's doing its job.
And that being said, like, we do have a bit of a desire to over-scale things, over to create too much redundancy, or not enough. I think there's been very little in between. We either over-engineer things as an industry, or we completely reduce the value of something and don't put... I don't see enough middle ground being learned. I see a lot of people providing high-end ideas, but, you know, I don't feel like it's a common thing. I think more or less people are learning as they go, and continue to learn as they go, as we've done in this silly industry for years.
So true. So very true.
So how did OnCall eventually change after, you know, you've run into all these issues of, you know, you're dealing with the what's up situation or what's running? Like, how do you eventually get past this and have greater, better OnCall for everyone?
So what eventually happened was the company grew exponentially, and we ended up having more and more machines to run. And at some point they gave us the budget to hire more people. And when we had more people, we actually had a relatively saner work schedule, is the best way to describe it. We weren't on call for 2 weeks out of the month or whatever. Like, we were able to be like on call maybe once every 2 months or something like that. The team grew significantly quickly. And we ended up starting to be able to actually spend the time and look at and audit what was going on and start actually get real observability and real understanding of what was required. And with that, we were able to bring up junior engineers to understand what was happening and to be able to build off of that. And we were able to share the load. It was more of a cultural shift with humans, more so than technology.
We still had the four people idea, if you will.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good way to sum it up. It was the ability to realize that the company had the understanding that they had put so much responsibility on four human beings to make sure the company didn't fail, that they realized they needed to invest in this specific spot.
Go ahead. Yeah, it's just how you learn about growth as a business.
Exactly. And I will tell you, at this time when we had four engineers, we had about 20 Java developers, right? Mm-hmm. And then by the time my tenure had ended, we actually had three different teams that the production engineers originally were responsible for. We had infrastructure engineers who only solely dealt with the perk cards and how the RAID was done and how backups were done. We had a whole DevOps team at the time who dedicated them to configuration management and understand how all that went. This was before DevOps was really a big thing. It was more of just kind of a statement more than anything. It was, in other words, we were just puppet developers. And then we had a middleware team that actually dealt with the Tomcats and who were really closer to the actual Java engineer. So we were able to, instead of four people dealing with everything and understanding how the whole world came together, we ended up having three teams of people of like 6, 7, 8, 9 people being able to run and understand what was going on. And they weren't all senior people, right? They weren't all like, you know, cowboys on the computer or whatever. They were like college grads who wanted to learn how to do IT. And they were willing to sit there and go through the motions of understanding how to exit Vim or whatever. That's supposed to be a joke.
Yeah, I guess. So let me start wrapping things up for you. So what would you say you all learned the most? Like, what was the big takeaway? Was it just the fact that you needed more people to help support everything, or was it just the big need for that full cultural shift?
I think it was really growth, right? And the ability for us to understand and audit what the system was actually doing. I realize how lame that sounds, but it's true. Like, there's, especially when you're responsible for an infrastructure, if you're responsible for a business as an operations person or as an on-call person, you need to spend the calories to understand why your system is set up the way it is, right? And it's not just give them a pager and give them a run book to go do something. If you really truly want to build your career off of this, you need to spend the calories to understand how, when a message comes in from one side and a message leaves from another, and what the functions between it actually do and why they even exist. And auditing and understanding that. And a lot of it can come from your simple Nagios box, right? To see why are we doing all this? But to take your point, why are we looking at load average? It doesn't mean anything. This shouldn't be an alert. And then all of a sudden you have this really nice holistic view. And that's what we needed. We didn't have it when we had four people. But when we had that 18 people running it or whatever it was, then we actually had a holistic view. And the quality of life changed drastically.
Very cool. So if there's a piece of advice to someone who's on call right now, what would you give?
Audit your monitoring. Have at least once a quarter, audit your monitoring. See if you actually need that stuff. Also, take that time they give you. When they tell you, you have flex days because you've been on call for X, Y, and Z time, or because you had to get up, take those days, even if it is just watching Netflix and turning off Slack, do that. You do not want to burn yourself out. It is not worth it, especially because life goes by really, really quickly, and I think you will miss out on things.
I think as a developer advocate, in which you are as well, I've found to be very, very similar in how I take on my life now and what I do, being on the road, working with people, writing conference talks, things like that. I found that, you know, if I found I'm on and I'm running a little ragged, things are taking more time than they should, I put a day in there or two. You know, I take that day because it helps me get back to where I need to be as good and as useful and helpful to other people. And the same could be said, I think, for people who are on call. If you don't let them rest and get back up to speed, they can't be very useful for you.
Exactly.
So thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk to you today, JJ. And before we finish up, I'd just like to find out if there are any projects you'd like to share, or you can let people know how to get in touch with you.
Yeah. I'm involved in DeliveryConf, which is happening in the January of 2020. Mm-hmm. I, if you're willing to let me plug it for a second here.
Sure, absolutely.
So we are having a conference dedicated to CD and CI. It's an opportunity for us to actually really talk about the one open space that shows up at DevOps days almost everywhere you go. So we have a conference truly dedicated to it. And then we have the speakers who set the tone for the room for 30 minutes. And then we have 20 minutes of the audience being able to sit down and talk about how that was going on to the future. So it's not just like how Jenkins works in your data center or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to understand what value you have from CDCI and how we can shape the future. If that is at all interesting to any of your audience members, please reach out at deliveryconf.com. And I know we have some promo codes. I don't know them off the top of my head. I should have done that beforehand, my bad. But reach out and we are really, really excited about putting this conference together.
Very cool. I will make a point to try to make it out there myself. I heard a little bit about
what was going on. I believe I talked to people like Sasha Rosenbaum, and I think it's going to be really interesting. So how can people also contact you personally if they'd like to reach out about after what you after this podcast? I know you got a lot to tell people about Kubernetes on the IBM cloud. So if they want to talk to you, how can they get in touch?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at JJ Asghar, A-S-G-H-A-R. And believe it or not, I have the email address of awesome. Yes, the word awesome at IBM.com.
So, that's really great. Hey, yeah. JJ, thank you so much for your time today, man. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This means a lot, Jay. It really does.
And I can't wait to get down to Texas so we can toss some beef onto a grill and talk more about things blowing up. So let's do that sometime in the future. Thank you again, man.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. We'll be right back to wrap up this episode of On-Call Nightmares. That's it for this week's episode of On-Call Nightmares. Thanks for listening as always, and if you'd like to be on the podcast, you can reach out to me. Just go ahead and send an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or you can reach out to me on Twitter. It's at oncallnightmare. Remember that I'll be at Microsoft Ignite in Orlando coming up in just a week or so, and I'd love to hear from you. So if you'd like to be on the podcast, reach out. Let's get things organized and let's get you part of a conversation. Same thing with DevOps Enterprise Summit. Reach out. Let's get you part of the conversation here on On-Call Nightmares. So for JJ and myself this week, thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time as I have more conversations with technologists who spent time on call.